This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look at the airport protests in response to Trump's executive order.
The National Lawyers Guild is stepping up for the challenge. We'll talk to King Downing about what they're doing.
In a recent article in The Nation, Lizzie Ratner examines United States immigration policies, specifically those of exclusion.
You could call it bomb 'em and ban 'em. And for millions and millions of Americans, it's morally repulsive.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. As confusion spread quickly last week over Trump's executive order to temporarily block refugees and deny entry to citizens from seven majority Muslim countries, protesters converged on airports across the nation. Defense attorneys set up shop in airport waiting areas as Customs and Border Protection officials detained legal permanent residents and visa holders while denying them access to counsel. Attorneys general from 16 states condemned the order, and National Lawyers Guild legal observers and defense attorneys were on full alert, rushing to monitor police activity at airports across the United States. Joining us for an update on this rapid response is the Guild's National Mass Defense Director, King Downing. Previously, King directed the Healing Justice Program of the American Friends Service Committee, where he worked on mass incarceration, including solitary confinement, prisoner advocacy, and conflict resolution. He is also the former national coordinator of the ACLU's Campaign Against Racial Profiling, which worked to identify and end stop and frisk, including the school-to-prison pipeline and other police abuse tactics. King Downing, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me here. I've followed the show for the longest time. My condolences around Michael Ratner. That was a big loss. But I'm also so happy to hear that you all have just spread all over the country, which is going to make my work easier because I'm going to tell people in our chapters, wherever they are, that they need to tune in. So I need to get that full list.
Fabulous. King, you and I took part in a National Lawyers Guild legal observer training last week as protesters were rushing to JFK Airport here in New York. How much advance notice did you have, and how did the Guild chapters rally to meet this countrywide challenge?
And I'd like to jump into that, but if you don't mind, just for a second, just to give a little background. I know that you've talked about the Guild a lot, but the Mass Defense Program and the committee go back to 1968 here in New York, the Columbia protests. Maybe you all have some close stories that follow that. But it was out of that that this whole program was set up in the committee to try to address this problem all around the country through the chapters. Now, it's a little bit sort of proprietary how much advance notice we get about these issues. But what we will say is that we have a great reputation with organizations, and they contact us just generally, hypothetically, when things are planning to happen.
Tell us, I didn't make it to the airport. What kind of police presence was there? And was the Port Authority the primary agency in charge here in New York?
The reports that we got were that it was primarily the NYPD, and that there was a stand down, although that doesn't change our general opinion of how the NYPD has policed in communities. But in this case, they did stand down, and there was a strong presence, but I can't say I wasn't there, so I don't know what kind of numbers there were.
How do you account for the stand down, King?
I don't know. I've been asked this a few times, and I've kind of taken a shorthand answer because I was at an event that Charles Barron was at, and he was saying after the election that because of the change in regime that you were going to see a lot of people who had been polishing up their resumes for jobs in Washington now out on the protest lines. So that's a shorthand way of saying that a lot of people who were institutionalized when the Democrats were in power are now also upset with what the regime is doing. And so I have a sense that the mayor, who probably because of the position on sanctuary cities, agrees. And so I think that there were a good number. I mean, the Guild was involved in, I think my count was 14 of our chapters reported that they had a legal presence at airports. And at almost all of them, the police had taken a low-key perspective. And I think I got a total of maybe 15 arrests that we've been able to confirm. There may have been more, but 13 in Seattle and 2 in Minneapolis.
That's astonishing.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
And when you say stand down, what did that mean with respect to protesters get out there? They didn't get vamped on. I mean, what happened?
Well, it seemed that the police, and I just speaking generally across all the airports, that the police were, I don't know, tolerant of people standing and chanting and moving around and kept an eye on them. And there were places where we got reports that people were blocked from going certain areas, but it wasn't get them all out the way we see on the street.
So there were no less lethal weapons.
I can't speak on what happened at the West Coast where there were the 13 arrests,
right,
but at least the kind of actions. We didn't get any reports of them going into crowds and spraying and beating people and pulling people out.
Riot gear, et cetera.
Yeah.
Good,
yeah.
Good. King, what kind of, there weren't that many arrests. What kind of legal defense did the Guild provide?
Well, I know in the case of the only places where we did have arrests were Minneapolis and Seattle, that the Guild is involved. We're there as legal observers, had lawyers on the scene, and we'll have more developments as time comes up.
You were in D.C. recently for the inauguration protests. What happened down there? Was that a different scene?
Everything happened. Everything happened. There were some things that the chapters expected, and there were some things that the chapters didn't expect. One of the things that we expected was that there were going to be people down there who were determined not to let people get into the inauguration or the parades. That's the kind of things we were hearing. We had contact with organizations like Disrupt J20, which was one of the larger organizers. We met with them, did a Know Your Rights workshop at the church where their activities were being held. But D.C. had, you know, I want to use the legal term, had been legally spanked by litigation earlier around the G8 protest in 2002, where they had kettled people and done all sorts of things that were unconstitutional and settled the number I heard was about a $14 million.
Yes, that's right.
$14 million lawsuit that from now on they were going to give 3 warnings, not kettle, distinguish.
Warnings to disperse.
Warnings to disperse. And so everything was running pretty smoothly. I was a legal observer coordinator for the Black Lives Matter protest, which turned into a blockade of an exit. We thought that was going to be a hot spot, and the police basically took a no-hands position and just allowed the entrance to be closed. And I guess we're diverting people to other places. So it went pretty much without incident. What did finally happen when I got back to the office after these events ended was that there had been a large kettling at 12th and L, and that's been the area of a lot of drama now. We're not sure exactly how it developed, but at some point when we got back, we got reports that hundreds of people had been kettled and were being held there for hours and hours.
Kettled means being surrounded.
Being surrounded by police.
And then arrested.
Well, for a long time, they were just being held there. In fact, I know at some point we're going to talk about innovations, but one of the innovations that I had suggested when I went down there that was very successful in Cleveland was the use of bicycle legal observers so that we could have people planted in geographic areas. And then if those areas were quiet, then they could just get on the bikes and move to the hotspots. And it went pretty well. So we had a couple of bicycles available, but we sent one lawyer by bicycle down to the kettle to try to negotiate with the police. Why are these people being held for hours, not able to go to the bathroom, not able to get any food? And when they finally started arresting them, the reports that we've gotten were that they were arresting one person every 15 minutes. They were just letting this drag on and drag on.
That's an interesting tactic. I've got to observe, King, that great innovation. A little late, given that in 2004 the NYPD was deploying police on bicycles. It's brilliant to have legal observers on them as well. But I wonder why it took us so long.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I got here in March, and we put this in place in June. So
great,
you know, I don't know.
Great
but,
innovation.
But see, I had it came from my experiences doing Cop Watch.
Right.
And so we had done it by vehicle, and it just seemed that the next step because our vehicles were getting stopped at the lights when the police drove through, ran the red light. So we thought, well, maybe bicycles are next. I said, well, let's try it at the Guild. And it worked real well in Cleveland.
King, let's talk about Trump. We expect a massive crackdown on the First Amendment-protected activities. You've been involved in, as you say, Black Lives Matter and many other mass demonstrations nationally. What are your predictions, despite the positive observations you've just made? What do you think is going to be the state of protest in the next year or so?
Wow. You know, we don't even have to predict. When we saw what happened during the primaries, we already saw people engaged, so it's really easy to predict now there are going to be 4 years of protests. Even election night and the night after, huge turnout. So it doesn't make me much of a genie. But a couple of things came to mind when you said that, and one was Frantz Fanon said, "Each generation must, out of relative obscurity, determine its mission, fulfill it, or betray it." And so I've been thinking a lot about how this generation has already stepped up right out of the blocks before things went, and I don't think they're going to stop. And the other one I thought of was Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, said that if the people don't organize themselves, conditions will. And so we had a case here where the people organized themselves right away, and I think conditions are just going to lead to more and more and more organizing.
There's an old union saying that the boss is the best organizer.
Yeah,
and,
right.
Thank you, Trump. I'm concerned the organizations that come out of this and the demonstrations that come out of this might come under attack by these Trump people. There were signs of that at the rallies. Was Trump was encouraging, if you punch somebody, I'll get a lawyer to defend you. Remember that statement? One report I read was a group of bikers showed up at a rally with guns. I mean, what I'm concerned about is you know, that kind of development.
We've already been talking about that. We're on that. We're actually already putting together a plan to extend to, and it's a delicate situation because of the Guild's view about protesters. We're not going to get in a position now where we're going to start collecting information on counter-protesters and turning it over to the police. But what we've come up with is that we're going to observe the counter-protest behavior. If we see any activity that crosses over the line to criminal, we are planning to collect that and turn it over to any defense lawyers who are representing people who got involved in those skirmishes on the organizer side or people who are filing civil claims. We're also putting a plan together that actually was already happening before all this started. And one example of it is in one of our states, we had gotten contacted by an abortion clinic where the counter-protesters were harassing the escorts who were bringing women into the clinic. And it was a new dimension for the Guild, and so we had a conversation about it, and we're still in talks. And the idea was that we would look for that kind of criminal behavior and not to begin to report it to the police, but also observe discriminatory treatment by the police based on the pro or anti-abortion position. And they were letting anti-abortion protesters drive their cars into areas where other people were blocked, letting their buses through when other people were being prevented from being there.
There are a lot of laws being passed and being proposed, not yet passed, in various state legislatures against demonstrators. One of the scary ones was out of North Dakota. You know what I'm talking about, King, where they proposed a law that allows motorists to drive into people who are protesting on the highway and not be prosecuted for actually running into somebody. What's your thoughts on that?
That is one of the most disgusting things that I've ever seen, to say that people who negligently hit protesters will not be found liable. And, you know, I can't remember right at the moment whether it talked about protesters or anybody on the highway going for gasoline. I think it was viewpoint based,
yeah.
So I think it's gonna fall.
It's a scary thing, but there are other sorts of laws that are being proposed also to limit protests.
Yeah, there were five of them, and just off the top of my head, because I've just been pulling them all down and collecting them. blocking highway or economic activity, which is kind of interesting because Black Lives Matter is on the highway, because when they stand out in front of the institutions who are denying their rights, they don't get any attention. When they march on the sidewalks, they don't. And even when they march on the streets in the cities, they don't get attention. So finally getting out to the highway, they do get paid attention, and they're raising counter-economic issues. So are you saying we're going to prefer for the trucks that still need to go here and there, but we're going to deny the historic economic issues that the people who are protesting have? So they're picking one over the other. And the other thing is that criminalizing protest is going down the same road we went down when we were dealing with mass incarceration, that you just, you know, getting tough on protest is not going to be the way to get out of this problem. You know, listening to the issues and taking them seriously and solving them is going to be the way to do it. And I don't think they're going to stand challenge, because they all seem to be viewpoint-based.
Would you explain that, please? That's an important constitutional concept, viewpoint-based. Help us out here.
Well, you know, the idea is that historically, you know, people with American flags are able to, you know, walk out onto malls and not be demanded permits and say, "We love America, God bless America." But then people who are challenging the government are prevented from doing it. And it's, you know, simply because the government prefers one political point of view over another, and it is restricting people or discriminating in the way they apply the First Amendment.
So the government is allowed to set limits on where and when people can protest, but they must be content neutral. So they can be, the parameters, for example, can relate to certain hours a day, or say, you know, in front of a specific building. But it can't discriminate based on the content of the message.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
King, you've been doing work related to the carceral state, racial justice for years. How did you get involved in what we call people's lawyering?
Well, there are only really two words, because I didn't really know a whole lot about it. There were only two sets of lawyers that I really knew much about as I was coming up. Those were the lawyers who were representing the Black Panther Party, and then Arthur Kanoy, basically. It was a picture I saw of him being carried out of the House Un-American Activities Committee, and I'd never seen a lawyer in that position.
You horizontal know, to the floor.
Yeah, but taking a stand and to the point of being physically, you know, committed to the point of being physically carried out. And so that was a big influence in me deciding to go to Rutgers. And Rutgers Newark, where he had taught for a long time. And I was an evening student. And so it was kind of a roll of the dice whether you'd get him for con law. And I wanted him for con law.
Constitutional.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You know, constitutional law. And I wanted him so badly, although I had Frank Askin, which was a great draw as well.
Right.
But so Arthur had a seminar called The Current Constitutional Crisis. And we had this running joke in the class, because he started out the first class in every class by saying, and my apologies, but I like to copy his voice, and it's out of love. "We're in the midst of one of the most egregious constitutional crises in the history of the United States." And we used to laugh because he had been teaching the class, I think, since the 50s. And every year he said we were in the midst of the most serious crisis. And the thing was, he was right.
He was right.
He was right.
Yeah.
So that's my in-school story. And if you indulge me one more, I have one outside.
Yes, we love Arthur.
At that time, I was an activist who went to law school to try to learn how to apply the law. And so I was very active in Jersey with groups who you may have had on, People's Organization for Progress, Larry Hamm.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
He's been on. So I was
right.
one of...
We know Larry.
Yeah.
We'll give him a shout out.
Show. Yeah, yeah. You all check out POP. There's always something going on there, and they need more people from this side of the river and over there to support them. But I was really in the thick of that movement, and we helped grow police brutality from a Newark issue to a New Jersey issue. Whenever we put the call out, Arthur would be there. We had a rally in front of the Star Ledger. He showed up. We had a situation where a young teenage woman was shot by a police officer in Montclair. He was trying to shoot at a dog, and the bullet skipped the ground and hit her in the leg. So she was relatively okay. But we had a march from her house to the Montclair police station, and Arthur shows up. You know, he's up in age at that time, and walking was a challenge. And they said, Arthur, and it's so great that you're here. We have a van for people who want to be part of the march and can ride down to the police station with it. He says, I'm here, and I'm going to march the entire distance. And you know.
Of course.
You know, it was like about a quarter of a mile, and he got out there, and he walked the whole way and then gave a speech at the end. Mm. So that was my inspiration.
We miss Arthur.
Yeah, yeah.
Politically, I totally identified with Arthur. One of his projects, particularly in the latter years, was to encourage people to organize their own political party. He had utterly given up on the Democratic Party. And I wanted to ask you, just in terms of strategic, long-range thinking, what do you think the possibilities of our having our own organization finally?
When you say our own organization?
A political party?
Eventually, I think we're going to need that to defend ourselves. I mean, Hillary Clinton sure did not do a good job for us.
So, you know, I'm taking my guild hat off, although I know that we probably have a lot of synchronicity within the progressive organization. We just haven't talked about, you know, which direction forward, but I can give my opinion.
Yeah.
I for a long time, I didn't vote. And then I learned that
I encouraged them.
and then I had I learned that we had the ability to write in names. So I just started writing in names of people because I thought, hey, if we can get the people who don't vote counted, then I think that we can go somewhere. And so after a while, when I was with POP, I started speaking to people and would say, okay, so 50% of the people don't vote. So they're completely written off as not even being in the system. So if we could get that half who have decided that they don't want to participate to even go in and write somebody's name down, all of a sudden the percentages of participation, instead of being, well, one person got 52% and one got 48%, it would be one got, you know, 35%, the other got 33%, and then 33% picked none of the above. That would begin to start to
legitimize.
Yeah, to legitimize it. And then one of the projects I was working on with some of the lawyers who were doing a lot of work around police brutality in Jersey, but who were also working with the Green Party, was that we were encouraging people to join any party, start your own party, and then we were in the process of putting together a debate of all the third parties, because the media wouldn't pay attention to any one of them, and it was going to be open to anybody who created a party. Whether it was you and five other people, everybody was welcome to join the debate, and we figured the media would cover it. And if we can get the corporate parties out, then everybody else can kind of fight for the ground, and I think a progressive populist movement would ultimately win.
King, a minute ago you referred to POP. What does that stand for?
I'm sorry. People's Organization for Progress.
Ah.
A longtime New Jersey organization dealing with a lot of different issues.
How can listeners learn more about legal defense, the guild's work, what you're doing?
Well, nationally, if people go to nlg.org, that will take you to the national website. But you are in so many cities and states now that we would urge people to go to the national site, click on chapters, find out where we have local chapters in your area, and click on that, and that will give information for lawyers and legal workers, and in some chapters where activists are eligible to join. It will also point out where people can get trained to be legal observers, where lawyers who want to volunteer can volunteer. And then going back to the national site, we have our Know Your Rights brochures, and I even have a green hat here, although nobody can see it, and I have one of our Know Your Rights books. And those can be downloaded, or by going on the website, we can send them to you. And then the last thing is that on the national page, we have the lists of about 15 so far and growing cities on the national list of people who can call if they have been arrested. So the arrest hotline numbers are on that page, too.
Give that website again, will you, please?
Yeah, it's just nlg.org, putting it into your search engine.
And just to underscore what you just said, King, is there are numbers in several jurisdictions where people can actually call for specific legal defense assistance.
Yes. Yes.
That's a great resource.
And if you're out there and you're one of the chapters, that, you know, let me know so we can add your number.
Great.
And we'll put that on lawanddisorder.org also,
great.
A link to that.
Great.
Well, King, you're doing critically important work. You're out there in the streets defending our rights, and we look forward to staying in touch as this new protest movement unfurls.
I'll see you out there in the streets.
You will.
Very, very good to have you on the show. King Downing, thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
President Trump barred entrance to refugees and visitors from the predominantly Muslim countries of Iran, Sudan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Yemen, and Libya, inspiring outrage and acts of solidarity. The conservative Cato Institute showed in a recent study that there were exactly zero terrorist attacks committed by people from these countries from the years 1975 to 2015. Last year alone, some 700 people died falling out of bed. Open immigration to the United States was cut off in 1920 by de facto religious quotas, excluding people from Eastern and Southern Europe, that is, Jews and Catholics. At that time, half of the world's Jews, some 3 million people, lived in Poland, and millions more in the surrounding areas. Those who did not escape were soon to perish in fascist death camps. Ray Kushner, Jared Kushner's grandmother, lost half her family when most of the 6,000 Jews in her town in northern Poland were killed. She escaped, hiding for a year in the woods, and then she was kept in a displaced person camp, like a refugee camp. And finally, in 1948, she was allowed into the United States. Our guest, Lizzie Ratner's family, escaped from Bialystok, Poland, and came to Cleveland in 1920. Just before the quotas could exclude them. She recently wrote an article for The Nation magazine, where she is a senior editor, on the fate of her family and that of the Kushners. Jared Kushner is Donald Trump's son-in-law and an advisor. Lizzie Ratner is Michael Ratner's niece.
Lizzie Ratner, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. It means a ton to be on with you and Michael right now.
Oh, thank you. You recently wrote an article for The Nation titled, "Nobody Wanted to Take Us In, The Story of Jared Kushner's Family and Mine." Please tell us what happened to your grandfather, Harry Ratner, who was Michael Ratner's father.
Well, the story of Harry Ratner, also known as Asher Radovser, is one of enormous good luck and enormous good timing. Harry was one of nine children who was born in Bialystok, what is now Poland, but what was which was Russia when he was born, in Germany during World War One. In 1920, his oldest brother, who had gone to the United States 14 years earlier, came back and said to the family, "You got to get out of here." It was an incredibly hard time in Bialystok at that point. Poland and the Soviet Union were fighting. The First World War had just ended. Life was hard and bad for Jews. There were pogroms. The family decided that they were going to leave and go to the United States. My grandpa Harry, though, had a problem, which was that he was of conscription age for the Polish army, which was not a happy place for Jews and really for anybody, I suspect, who was being conscripted into the army. And so in order to leave Poland, he had to sneak out. He could not leave legally. So he and one of his older brothers, who was also of conscription age, they dressed up as farmers and cattle herders. They snuck out of Poland and into the, sort of what was then the free city of Danzig, which is now Gdansk. And the first time my grandfather tried to sneak out, he was actually caught by a bunch of German border guards. He was hiding in a haystack overnight after having crossed out of Poland. He was caught. He was sent back to Poland. He tried again. He got out successfully. But once he was in Danzig, he had another problem. He had forged passports. And the sort of family story goes that because he had these forged passports, he was not eligible for a visa to the United States, for a visa, they called it at the time. His older brother, my great uncle Kalman, who was the one who had gone to the United States and said, "You guys, you got to get out of Poland," he basically interceded, the story goes, with the American consul in Germany. They were both Freemasons, which is sort of a wild and crazy story. And apparently, my great uncle worked some Freemason magic and managed to get my grandfather approved for travel to the United States. So this is all a lot of wind-up to say that my grandfather's journey to this country was not assured. And if his timing had been different, things would have been very, very bad, possibly, for him, because my grandfather arrived in October 1920. In May 1921, the United States passed really the second in a series of three draconian anti-immigrant acts that were intended to really limit immigration, first from pretty much all of Asia, which is shocking. You heard that right, almost all of Asia. Also, the sort of xenophobes who were controlling Congress at the time really wanted to limit immigration of Jews, Catholics, Eastern Europeans, Southern Europeans. So they passed these extreme measures. The second one in 1921 imposed a quota system. And the quota system made it significantly harder for lots of people from Eastern Europe to get to the United States, including Jews like my family. So all of this is a long way of saying my family got here about 6 months before the borders really started to close. Now, this is significant, we now know, historically, because once the borders closed in the 1920s, they remained closed for well over 20 years.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you about, Lizzie. You know, with Trump, we're now witnessing the revival of an anti-immigrant regime. Mm-hmm. And what kind of anti-immigrant fervor was created in the 20s that caused them to close down those borders?
That's a great question, and the answer is an interesting one, because as I was researching my article, what I noticed was that there's enormous similarity, rhetorically as well as in some ways politically, between the late 19-teens and early 20s, when the United States closed its borders, and this moment now. So let's pause. Before we even get into the rhetoric, let's look at the history a little bit. This was a moment which was politically quite similar, or had some, notable similarities to today. It was sort of the end of the First World War, which was a moment which created numerous refugees in Europe and Eastern Europe, people who were desperate to get out and go to a place where there wasn't war, where they would have a home and there wasn't hunger. In addition, there was, the Russian Revolution. And so you had the rise of communism, which really freaked out people in the United States. And so there was actually, in 1919, the first Red Scare. We're really familiar with the second Red Scare that happened in the 1950s, but there was a preview to that ugly moment in 1919 when there was a initial Red Scare, and people in this country became very scared of immigrants in particular who would come over from Russia and would be stealth Bolsheviks, stealth communists, and try to turn the country red from the inside. There was also a big fear of anarchists. So that was part of the fear of Italian anarchists like Sacco and Vanzetti who would come here and wreak havoc. It was also sort of the rise of the eugenics movement, a flourishing moment for eugenics. So there was this racism. And all of that kind of conspired to form a really intense xenophobia and nativism. And so there was language at the time that we hear that really, I think, echoes some of the stuff we're hearing today. So, for instance, if I could just even read to you something. In 1920, there was a famous congressional report that was published calling for the temporary suspension of immigration. One of the figures behind the report was Albert Johnson, who was a really sort of xenophobic, racist, anti-labor congressman from Washington State who would ultimately go on to sponsor the 1924 legislation really closing down the borders. So the report says, "It is impossible to overestimate the peril of the class of emigrants coming from this part of the world, and every possible care and safeguard should be used to keep out the undesirables." Now, that was specifically referring to Jews from Poland. But I think, you know, we might not be surprised to hear that language today used to describe Muslims, Syrian refugees, or Mexicans. In that same report, Jews are referred to as filthy, as abnormally twisted, as physically deficient, incapable of becoming American. I mean, really ugly, ugly language that we hear, you know, in slightly more modern form, but echoed today. You know, what's disturbing is a lot of people have talked about, are we in a ninth Germany 1933 moment? I think, you know, that's a valid question, but I think we can also look to our own history and these certain strains that have been in this country forever and say, well, actually, are we in an America 1920 moment?
Yeah, really.
Lizzie, tell us what happened to Jared Kushner's grandmother. You quote her as saying, "Nobody opened the door for us. Nobody wanted to take us in."
Yeah, so when I was sort of researching some of my own family's history and thinking about this stuff, I came across an oral history interview with Jared Kushner's grandmother, Ray Kushner. Ray Kushner is a survivor of the Holocaust, and she seems like a truly remarkable, strong woman who survived abject and unbelievable horror. And the fact that she sort of was able to put a sentence together and speak with dignity and grace after that is a source of real sort of awe for me. So her family's story is this. They were from a town, I'm going to massacre the name a little bit, but it's Nowogródek, which was in Poland at the time and is currently in Belarus. They were a Jewish family, middle-class Jewish family. She was born in 1923. Her father was a furrier. They had hat stores. They were doing okay. But in the 1930s, anti-Semitism became really virulent in the area. And obviously you had Nazi Germany beginning to rise. And there were friends of the Kushner family. Their last name was actually Kushner. So there were friends of the there. Her last name was Kushner. So there were friends of the Kushner family who said, "We're getting out of here. We're going to Palestine. Things are too hot. Things are too dangerous here. You should leave too." And what Ray Kushner says in this interview is, "Where could we go? We couldn't get a visa to Palestine. We couldn't get a visa to the United States. You would have to wait, you know, several years if you wanted to get into that country. And, you know, if you had a family with lots of children like my father, it was just almost impossible. We had nowhere to go." Then the interviewer asked her, "So did your family try?" And she says, "Yes, my father had a sister in the United States, but we couldn't do it." And literally the next sentence after that in the interview, she says, "And then in 1941, the Germans came." And so you really sort of see the connection in that moment. Her family was sort of trapped in Eastern Europe and wasn't able to leave. And then in 1939, actually, the Soviets came. And then 1941, the Germans came. And they corralled all 6,000 Jews in her town, along with 24,000 other Jews from neighboring towns, into a ghetto. And for more than 2 years, it was just, you know, constant selections and torment and murder until by 1943, out of the 30,000 Jews that had been in the ghetto, there were 350 left. Somehow, she and her father and younger sister were among those survivors, but her mother and her brother, but her mother and older sister were killed during those 2 years. Now, there's sort of a famous story. What happened is the 350 surviving Jews said, "We have to do something. And so they dug a tunnel out from under the ghetto. And Ray Kushner's younger brother was killed and ended up dying when he was sort of caught on the other side of the tunnel. But Ray Kushner and her father and younger sister survived. They were rescued by Tevye Belsky, the partisan, the famous partisan, and spent almost a year in the forest, surviving in really difficult conditions, but surviving. She says in the interview, it was just incredibly scary being in the forest, but they survived. Then Novogrudok was liberated, and they went back. You know, like so many people, Jewish people at the time, they found that the town was not actually welcoming. There was anti-Semitism. It was hard to make a life there. So they decided they wanted to leave. And they encounter the same problem they encountered 10 years earlier. And she says in the interview, nobody would take us in. The doors were closed to us. There was nowhere they could go in 1944, 1945.
Lizzie, what was the position of the United States? You say there was nowhere to go. Yeah. What was the position of the United States with respect to allowing Jews to come into America in the 1930s? I mean, after all, the government here knew that their Jews there were being murdered.
Yeah, well, so it's a great question, and there's an interesting long answer. The quotas remained in place. And the United States wasn't about to bend the quotas for anybody. But in addition to the quotas remaining in place, I'm just going to loop back for one sec to the early 1930s when Hoover sort of didn't go through Congress but initiated administrative efforts to make it even harder for people to come to the United States. So there were these laws in place, but there were also these administrative efforts so that when people went to apply for visas at consulates, they would almost always get turned down. In the 1930s, the United States had no interest really in opening up the doors for Jews. It was the Depression. There was a lot of fear that Jews would come and other people would come and take jobs. And so that was sort of one of the prime motivating factors, along with the fact that the State Department was virulently anti-Semitic. So even in 1940, when it became clear, you know, that things were really, really, really bad for Jews, there was no opening the gates. Actually, let me go back for 1939. There's the famous story of the SS St. Louis, the boat of German Jewish refugees that sought first to go to Cuba, the United States, Canada, and was turned away by all three countries. They did not want the Jews to come in. And the boat was turned back, and it went back to Europe. Some of the Jews on that boat were taken in by countries in Europe, amazingly. But several hundred were sent back to Germany and ultimately died in the Holocaust. So, and here's sort of the crazy thing, is in the late 1930s and early 1940s, particularly, you know, once the war starts, it's clear that Jews are, you know, some of the prime victims of the Nazis. And yet, out of the State Department, this kind of crazy theory comes to justify excluding Jews. And here's what the theory is. Jews are going to be a fifth column. We can't let them into the country because they might spy for the Nazis. If they come here, their families could be held hostage by the Nazis, and they will be forced to spy for them. And so Jews, who are the Nazis, you know, amongst their chief victims, are not allowed into the country because people in the State Department say, oh, my God, they could actually be spies for the Nazis. I mean, that's some of the most twisted and tortured logic you can imagine.
Unbelievable. But, you know, the stopping of Jewish immigration from Europe was one of the most significant events of modern Jewish history. Mm-hmm. Jared Kushner must know that. His wife, the converted Jew Ivanka, must know that. His father-in-law must know that. What do you think will be the effect of closing our borders to Arabs and Muslims, people from the Middle East and people from Africa?
I mean, I think, you know, history teaches us, although I don't even think we need history, I think we just need to open our eyes now and look. But there are desperate people. There are 65 million refugees, the worst refugee crisis since the Second World War. People are desperate. And by closing our borders, there are sort of two scenarios, and neither of them is pretty. One is that people aren't able to leave their countries and end up either, you know, suffering torment and torture or actual death. I mean, that's what happens to people when they are stuck in countries that are war-torn and dangerous. But the other scenario is, listen, we already have a lot of refugees who are in refugee camps, and they're not pleasant places. They're horrible places. And so by closing the borders, it means that people will suffer in refugee camps even longer. And yes, they might be alive. They might not be in Syria. They might not be sort of suffering Assad's bombs. But they are going to be in, you know, the cold and exposure and misery of refugee camps. And so, you know, again, we can look to history, and I would love to return to Jared Kushner's grandmother's story because she was essentially in a refugee camp for a period. But we can also just open our eyes to the present and say, this is unconscionable.
Lizzie, why do you call Trump a pathologically cynical president?
I guess because he is clearly pathological. There is some sort of pathology at work in almost everything he seems to do. And the cynicism is that I think he is, I have no reason to doubt that he is xenophobic and racist, but I also think the cynicism is that he is also willing to use these sort of noxious ideas and the movements that support these noxious ideas to coalesce power, you know, and to sort of keep power. And he knows that he's riding these sort of ugly strains of anger and hate toward power. So I think, you know, very likely he believes this stuff, but I also think there's a utilitarian element on his part that recognizes that that this is all good for consolidating his power. So that's sort of what the cynicism is.
What have American Jewish organizations and leaders been saying about the Trump ban? There's an ancient Jewish commandment about loving your neighbor as yourself. Has this become relevant now?
Yeah, well, it's a real mix. You have a number of progressive organizations that have been speaking out and protesting and calling on Trump and calling on Jared Kushner and saying, you know, our people were the victims of the first, not the first, but one of the major closings of the borders in this country. And we have an obligation to welcome other people so that they don't have to suffer the fate that Jews suffered. So you have groups like Bend the Ark, Trua, you have obviously the wonderful Jewish Voice for Peace, you have a lot of synagogues, you have an excellent group named Hias, which is very interesting, and I'll tell you about that in a sec, but they're all coming out. You have 200 Jewish historians coming out and saying, you know, history and our history tells us this is wrong. But you also have a number of Jewish groups that have been completely silent, the more conservative Jewish groups, which have been perhaps pleased with the Trump administration's appointment of a conservative settler for ambassador, are sort of pleased with where they see things going on Israel and don't, you know, aren't willing to critique Trump on this other stuff. So it's been a mixed bag, but I have been enormously inspired and pleased by the work I've seen from a number of Jewish groups, really vocal Jewish groups. And so I'd love to talk about Hias, which is an organization that might very possibly be the oldest refugee resettlement organization in the world. And it's certainly the oldest Jewish one. It was started in 1881, Lower East Side of New York, as the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. And they were helping to resettle the first wave of Jewish immigrants that came to this country in the 1880s. And they were enormously active, really, with Jewish refugee resettlement for the next 100 years. And they helped my family when we were on the boat, when my great aunts and uncles and grandfather were on the boat to this country, and when my family was actually, some of my relatives were quarantined on Ellis Island. They fed them. They helped them. They helped the Kushners when the Kushners were in a displaced persons camp after the war. And the head of the organization is a man named Mark Hetfield. And about 15 years ago, the organization pivoted and shifted its focus. It said, you know what, our job at this point is not to help Jews. Our job is to help everybody who is in a position that Jews were in. And so their motto is, you know, we used to help people because they were Jews. Now we help people because we are Jews, meaning, you know, we draw on our history to sort of try to prevent other people from having to suffer, or at least, you know, we try to sort of lessen the suffering. And so so I spoke to Mark Hetfield at Hias, and the group has been organizing a lot around Syrian refugees well before Trump. They were organizing synagogues to take in refugees, rabbis to lobby Congress and Obama and say, like, come on, let in Syrian refugees. This is outrageous. And so I spoke with Mark Hetfield, and he had a number of interesting things to say about sort of the role of Jewish history and also sort of text in outlining what a, you know, Jewish response might be at this moment. And, you know, first he said our history is one of persecution and going from one place to another, seeking a home, seeking a place to take us in. And in the, you know, late 19th and earliest 20th century, we were lucky to get into this country. Many that, you know, the fairly open Jewish immigration of that period is what has allowed there to be a Jewish community in the United States. And then he said, but the door is closed to us, and we suffered the consequences. And then he said to me, you know, so for us to say now, for the Jews who are in the United States now, to say, okay, we're here now, you can close the doors on everybody else, he said that is morally reprehensible, which I thought was about as clear a statement as one can make. And then he also sort of drew on the textual tradition, which, as you pointed out, says, you know, you shall welcome the stranger in your midst because you were strangers once in the land of Egypt. And I am not a Torah scholar, but according to Mark Hetfield, it is considered such an integral, essential notion in the Jewish religious tradition that it's repeated 36 times in the Torah, possibly more than any other commandment. And, you know, it's considered defining. So anyhow, you know, one would hope that Jared Kushner, who is an observant Jew, whose family really first suffered the worst of exclusion from this country, and then ultimately was let in and suffered the wonderful benefits of inclusion, you know, one hopes that he is beginning to think about that history and sort of how it should guide him in the present moment.
Lizzie, we just have a couple of minutes left, and for our final parting thoughts, we'd like to hear you explain why the anti-immigrant policies in the U.S. in the 1920s were baseless and destructive, and why Trump's current policy is the same, baseless and destructive.
Well, I mean, I think we can, you know, looking at the 1920s, we see the language was completely paranoid. It was painting, taking these sort of really neurotic and cockamamie ideas, Jews and Italians as these subversives who are going to come in and take over and destroy the country, and painting whole populations with those warped, neurotic ideas. So, I mean, I think whenever you try to paint a whole population and with a crazy idea, that's baseless. And it was destructive because, you know, because we closed the gates then, because this country closed the gates then, millions of Jews did not get into this country. And, of course, it wasn't just Jews. I mean, I'm focusing on Jews because that's my family's story. It's Jared Kushner's story, and we can really measure the consequences. But there were millions of people from all over the world who couldn't get in, and for whom life would have been really different. I know I'm talking a lot here, but let's just look at sort of the most extreme example, Anne Frank. Her father tried desperately, Otto Frank tried desperately to get into the United States in 1939. For months, he offered money. He rounded up money. He was friends with the Strauss family, which I think is part of the Macy's dynasty. He had friends in high places. He could not get in. And as the author of an article, I'm going to forget which magazine, but, you know, said while writing of Anne Frank's family's failed attempts to get in, he said, you know, but for those immigration bans, Anne Frank would be, you know, like an 80-year-old woman living in Boston, probably writing great books. So, you know, it's about as destructive as it gets. And, you know, in terms of today, the idea that these millions of desperate refugees are going to come here and try to destroy the country, when not a single person taken in from any of the 7 targeted countries has committed an act of violence in this country. I mean, no terrorist act in this country has been committed by somebody from any of the 7 targeted countries. So it's just sort of fantasy, the idea of targeting all, you know, Mexicans as rapists. You know, baseless, it's just insane. It's almost too insane to even sort of pick apart because it's so obviously baseless and unwarranted, and comes from a place of sort of insecurity and fear-mongering within our country, and also just sort of racism. And destructive because there are people, obviously we've been talking mostly about the sort of the refugees and people from the Muslim-targeted countries, but there are many Latin Americans who are fleeing incredibly violent situations in their country, or just economically desperate situations in their country, situations caused in part by American policy. So, you know, here it is. We sort of wreak havoc in these parts of the world, and then we close the borders and say you can't get out.
Yeah, really. Well, Lizzie, we've come to the end of our allotted time, and I just wanted to reflect for a second. You know, one of the reasons that Heidi and I loved Michael Ratner, your uncle, was his moral compass. And I have to say, you're carrying on the family tradition.
Michael. Thank
you so much for being with us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Thank you guys so much. It means the world to be on talking to you.
Oh, always a pleasure.
I wish Michael were here, too, but...
We do, too.
Thank you for including me.
Thank you, Lizzie. Lizzie Ratner.
Okay. Bye.
You want to hear Law and Disorder again? Go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.